for our committee meeting on March 13th, 2025? And if so, would you be willing to move their approval?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Rarick moves the approval of the minutes for March 13th, 2025. Is there any discussion? Representative Claiborne. Representative Claiborne, at that time under our power sharing agreement, I was a non-voting member. So that is accurately reflected in the minutes. Are there any other questions or discussion to Co-Chair Rarick's motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes for March 13th, 2025 are approved. Members, we are going to hold off on approving the minutes for the Joint Regents meeting from March 18th, 2025. We did notice an error in those, and the accurate minutes were printed off last minute. That was what caused the delay in our committee hearing start time. But rather than approve those minutes right now, we're going to give members the opportunity to review them, and we will have the motion to approve those in our next meeting coming up on Thursday. Vice Chair Coulter, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes for our March 20th, 2025 meeting? And if so, would you be willing to move their approval?
Yes and yes.
Vice Chair Coulter moves approval for the minutes of March 20th, 2025. Is there any member discussion? Representative Claiborne. All right. Okay, thank you for catching that. Representative Claiborne, I'm going to go ahead and table Vice Chair Coulter's motion, and we can pick up those minutes on, hopefully, Madam Co-Chair, which we can get those adjusted, and we can move their approval on Thursday.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Rarick.
Or you could do an oral amendment and then approve them, unless there's other issues.
All right. Representative Claiborne. Representative Rarick.
So then let's lay them over and do a motion to reconsider the previous minutes, and we will also either amend them and move them or lay them over.
Representative Rarick moves motion to reconsider the approval of the minutes from March 13th, 2025. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I make an oral amendment to add Representative Claiborne to the list of members present, because you definitely were present. I recall that very well. And you are a great member of this committee. It was just an oversight. My apologies, Representative Claiborne. I will make a motion to add her as the oral amendment.
Representative Rarick moves that we do an oral amendment to the minutes of March 13th, 2025, to reflect the fact that Representative Claiborne was indeed present. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes are amended. Chair Rarick, would you care to move the approval of the minutes for March 13th, 2025 as amended?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rarick moves the approval of the minutes for March 13th, 2025 as amended. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 13th, 2025 are approved as amended. Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe we've acted on the minutes for March 20th, so I will make an oral amendment to reflect the fact that Representative Cleburne was indeed present at our committee meeting on March 20th.
Vice Chair Coulter moves an oral amendment to the minutes for March 13th, 2025 to reflect the fact that Representative Cleburne was in fact present at the meeting. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the oral amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Coulter, would you care to move the approval of the minutes for March 20th, 2025 as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Vice Chair Coulter moves that the minutes for March 20, 2025 be approved as amended. Is there any member discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes for the March 20th, 2025 are approved as amended. Members, the first bill on our agenda for today is House File 2425. I am the chief author of this bill, so I will be handing the gavel over to Vice Chair Coulter. Excuse me, 2454.
All right, looks like we are good to go. Chair Wolgamott, would you like to move House File 2454 be laid over?
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 2454 be laid over.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Vice Chair Coulter, Co-Chair Rurick, my fellow members of the Higher Education Committee, I am here today to present House File 2454, the Minnesota Law Enforcement Scholarship Act. I'm bringing this bill forward because right now Minnesota is facing a law enforcement workforce shortage that has a direct threat to the safety and security of our communities. Right now there are over 1,000 open positions in law enforcement that are vacant waiting to be filled. Stacked on top of that, there are over 2,700 members of the law enforcement community who are in the retirement age between 50 and 55. Given that we have a total workforce of 10,000 officers, those numbers represent up to a third of our workforce in law enforcement. This is a crisis, and the state of Minnesota needs to use every tool in our toolbox to make sure that we have enough officers on our streets and our communities keeping us safe. One of those tools that we have in the Higher Education Committee are scholarships. That's why we're bringing this bill forward. What the bill does is it would create a scholarship, last dollar scholarship for licensed police officers and their dependents to be able to pursue a degree within the fields of criminal justice and law enforcement at any of our MinState colleges and universities and any of the University of Minnesota colleges and universities. This legislation has been modeled after successful legislation in the state of Nebraska and will accomplish the goal of attracting police officers from other states to come to Minnesota. We will be able to retain the officers that we have and educate and empower the next generation of law enforcement. Mr. Vice Chair, Madam Chair, members, that's why we're bringing this bill forward. That's what the bill does. And Mr. Vice Chair, I do have some testifiers here who can shed further light on the importance of passing House File 2454.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. I see the one testifier listed is Mark Ross. Good afternoon. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Coulter, Chair Rurick. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of this legislation today. My name is Mark Ross. I'm the president of the St. Paul Police Federation. I've been a police officer in the city of St. Paul for 24 years. I am also on the board of directors for the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. For several years now, many of us in our profession, along with several lawmakers, have been looking for ways to recruit and retain police officers And this is a great step in that direction. We have a lot of trouble coming up with ways to both retain our current officers and attract new officers, and this is a great way to do that. I can tell you right now in St. Paul, we are down about 75 officers. Over in Minneapolis, they're down about 400. And statewide, we are down 1,000. What a bill like this would do, specifically in St. Paul, is we have people that are on the cusp or at least eligible to retire. We would be able to retain several of those officers because of a bill like this, because they would have dependents in our state college and university system. What we're also trying to do in terms of recruitment in law enforcement right now, we are trying to recruit folks to get into law enforcement from other professions. This becomes extremely attractive to some of those folks who might not otherwise like to enter public service, as this would be a benefit that they themselves could take advantage of if they don't already have a four-year degree, but also their dependents. On behalf of the MPPOA and police officers throughout the state of Minnesota, we very much support this. And again, this is a great step forward in dealing with our recruitment and retention issue. We truly are on the cusp of a crisis here within the next 5 years if we don't begin to fill our ranks. Again, thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions that any committee members may have.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. I am not seeing anybody jump forward. Any questions for Mr. Ross? That was the only testifier we had signed up. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on House File 2454? Not seeing anybody else up, so we will close testimony, move on to member discussion. Representative Lotney.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Wolgamott, what happens to these funds if they don't get used up in the first part of the biennium? Will they roll over? Will they cancel back?
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Novotny. So to your question, I should also note that, as I'm sure members can see, we do not yet have a fiscal note on this bill. That's one of the reasons why we're laying it over. My hope is that we still need to get our target. Co-Chair Eric and I will be having those discussions what we do with that target. But I'm really hoping that we're able to find some money for this, anywhere from a pilot program to as much investment as we can get to make this as an attractive of a program as possible. The way that I would like to have it set up is so that any money that we get is able to be there and continue to, if it's not used, then roll over, just so that this opportunity is available for our police officers and their dependents.
Representative Devani.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Chair Wolgamott, one more question. Okay, so this is a last dollar program. Can it be used in connection with, like, the IC Poet grants if we extend that again, or how would that play in with this being a last dollar grant?
Chair Wolgamott.
That's right. So it says in the bill that it is, it's last dollar. So all other gift aid that's available would be applied before the application of this scholarship.
Thank you, Chair. That's it.
Members, any further discussion? Chair Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know that OHE has transfer authority, and so if there is a grant that's underutilized, that it's possible for them to move that to a different grant. So I'm not sure that it's written in that way. I was looking through the language, and I didn't see that, but maybe if we have one of our nonpartisan staff kind of answer that, because that is a possibility. So when grants aren't fully utilized, there's a transfer authority within OHE, but it's defined, and so I'm not sure if this is in that definition. I'm wondering if our nonpartisan staff knows that answer. Hopefully I've talked long enough for you to look it up.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, members, so typically the Omnibus Appropriations Act that the legislature passes gives the Office of Higher Education transfer authority to transfer unencumbered balances for various programs to other programs that OHE administers. So that could be addressed in the Omnibus Act if this program is included.
Thank you.
But it's not a default or anything like that.
Chair Rarick?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. So something else we can discuss, too, if we find some money in the corners and cracks of our budget for this, that we would, well, I would defer actually to the public safety chair, because I'm assuming, just as you had said, that you really don't want it to transfer out somewhere else, and so that should be addressed. So I just want to get that on the public record, that your desire, and it sounds like the chair of public safety's desire, is that it be used and encumbered for this grant and not move somewhere else. So we'll have to address that in the omnibus.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. Chair Wolgamott.
Yeah, that's correct, Madam Chair. Thank you. I look forward to doing that work with you and making sure that we have the legislative intent of any dollars that we are able to get for this scholarship are specified for the scholarship and for the recruitment and retention of police officers in Minnesota.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Not seeing anybody. Chair Wolgamott, any closing comments?
Well, thank you again, Mr. Vice Chair and Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to present this bill. In closing, I want to be very clear. The goals of this bill are to address Minnesota's workforce crisis in law enforcement by attracting new officers to come to the state of Minnesota, by retaining the current officers that we have, and by empowering and educating the next generation of law enforcement. That's what this bill will do, and I'd like to thank Officer Ross and all of the police officers across the state of Minnesota for the work that you do to keep us safe, and we want to have your back here in the legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Wolgamott renews his motion to lay over House File 2454. Bill is laid over.
Members, the next item on our agenda is House File 1603 by Vice Chair Coulter. Vice Chair Coulter, would you like to move that your bill be laid over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Thank you. Please proceed with your presentation.
Excuse me. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 1603 basically just makes permanent the paramedic scholarship that was established in our previous, in the 2023 higher education budget. And I do want to also point out, if you haven't gotten a chance to read it yet, Office of Higher Education has put out a report on this particular scholarship, and it is mercifully short, only 13 pages, I think, so makes for relatively easy reading. So we are all, I'm sure, aware of the EMS personnel crisis that we face in the state of Minnesota. I'm sure you're all hearing about it from hospitals and clinics and mayors and other public safety professionals. And paramedics certainly are no exception. And the genesis of this bill really comes from the fact that we simply cannot afford to do nothing. 24%, almost a quarter of our current paramedics are over the age of 50, and less than 16% are under the age of 30. We simply are not producing enough paramedics at the moment to succeed the folks who are retiring from the profession. So in our 2023 budget, as I mentioned, we included a one-time $3.2 million establishing this paramedic scholarship program, and it has been just incredibly successful. Just in 1 year, there were more than 800 applications for this scholarship, and nearly 300 students received them. Two-thirds of those students are under the age of 30, and I thought notably 39% of the students who received scholarships are women compared to only 30% of current paramedics. So as I said, House File 1603 would make this scholarship program permanent, ensuring that we can continue to build up our paramedic force and serve the next generation. So with that, I will turn things over to my testifiers.
Thank you very much. Representative Coulter, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, Buck McAlpin here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association In the 30 years I've done this, this legislature has been very supportive around our basic first responder training, EMT training, but we really never didn't do any work around the paramedic level, the advanced life support level, until this program 2 years ago. And that really came out of the genesis of just folks had left the industry, especially during the COVID period we all went through. And I would say this has been, and I see Mr. Johnson over here from higher ed, the relationship between the industry, the EMS division, Mr. Ferguson will talk about a minute in higher ed. I've never seen a program that was so well advertised from higher ed. They just did an amazing job getting this out to our providers. And to Representative Coulter's point, we are seeing younger folks come into the career. I was started as a paramedic in 1983, long ago. And the gray-haired group like mine is growing very rapidly. And although we're still seeing a lot of success in this program, Director Ferguson will give you some data that shows we're still seeing more people leaving the industry, like law enforcement just testified to, as we see coming into it, which is alarming. And we really appreciate the support of this committee to try to extend it, because I think in this application round right now, higher ed says we're continuing to see lots of applications apply to come into it. And most importantly, they have to be part of an ambulance service and be represented. So they've already completed their emergency medical technician 140-hour basic course to go on to the more extensive paramedic job.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott, Chair Rarick. My name is Dylan Ferguson. I serve as the director for the Minnesota Office of Emergency Medical Services. Mr. McAlpin had kind of highlighted some different aspects related to what we're seeing with the paramedic workforce, and I like to share some figures of, you know, how those paramedics that we do have are contributing to our system. So Mr. McAlpin had kind of highlighted some of the differences between our emergency medical technicians and our paramedics, and what we find is that a paramedic is twice as likely to be in the active practice of pre-hospital medicine in the back of an ambulance as compared to one of our emergency medical technicians. So we have 4,135 paramedics in Minnesota. We have 11,665 emergency medical technicians. 70% of our paramedics are running calls every week, every month, whereas with some of our EMTs, we've only got a workforce participation rate on an ambulance of about 34%. Paramedics make up about 13% of our workforce in emergency medical services, but they are present on almost 85% of Minnesota's 700,000 911 and interfacility transfer calls every year. The reason why I highlight this is when we are looking to kind of, if you will, get the biggest bang for the available limited funds, investing that into our paramedic workforce just makes sense numerically. While emergency medical technicians, particularly in our rural areas, will always serve as the bedrock of our EMS system, it's our paramedics who are our true workhorses. And a part of this reason is because individuals are that hold their paramedic credential are more likely to make emergency medical services their part-time or full-time career because they have placed more of an investment in themselves, if you will, when it comes to their education. Rather than a 140 or 150-hour course, Minnesota paramedics undergo upwards of 2,000 hours of training, including an additional 500 to 600 of field internship and clinicals. When we take a look at supply and demand, the demand for paramedics has been increasing year over year as more ambulance services look to upgrade their service from basic life support to advanced life support and following the desires and the needs of their communities. But we have also seen the number of paramedics leaving our profession increase. Up until 2020, we actually created more paramedics than we lost each fiscal year. That changed, though, in 2021. In 2021, we saw 79 more expirations than we saw people come in. In 2022, that number was negative 14. In 2023, there was a deficit of 85. And the most recent statistics we have for 2024 was a paramedic deficit of 113, meaning that 113 more people left than what we were able to create. Now, when we take a look at trying to recruit and retain different individuals within the workforce, one of the challenges that we run into is that it's difficult to ask a sometimes relatively young emergency medical technician to make an investment in themselves for their education, to take that next step, to attend those courses and gain those higher skills. And the reason for that is because the median salary for an emergency medical technician in Minnesota, according to the latest deed data, is $22.65 an hour. When we take a look and we compare to some other industries, we find that that figure is 83% less than what we see for a law enforcement officer, 21% less than that of a construction laborer, and significantly less than other aspects within the healthcare continuum. As a result, it's difficult to expect that individual to make an investment in their education, which can total $5,000 to $10,000, while there are so many other professions, both within and outside of healthcare, that maybe are more financially sound or more financially beneficial to the individual. To date, federal and state governments have historically made investments in education support or loan forgiveness programs for healthcare providers who will work in rural or underserved areas. But up until our paramedic scholarship program in the 2023 session, the state really had no options, and the federal government still does not recognize paramedics or EMTs as an available option to use some of those forgiveness dollars. We've seen the early benefits of this program with its implementation. Paramedic enrollments are up, and I, too, want to just compliment the Office of Higher Education. They've been phenomenal to work with. This has been a state program that has worked well. It has worked as designed, and I certainly feel that it is worthy of consideration for being reauthorized and continued. So, Chair Wolgamott, that will conclude my testimony this afternoon, and I appreciate you and appreciate the representative for bringing forward the bill.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony, Director Ferguson. Are there any members of the public who are wishing to testify on House File 1603? Seeing none, we will open it up to member questions and discussion. I recognize Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this, Representative Coulter. Mr. Ferguson, thank you. That was really great. Really appreciate hearing all that data and having you pull that together for us. The question that I have, I know often, you know, in the health space, we've done a lot on different kinds of training for ambulance service. And I wonder if you, I'm sure you don't have this with you today, although I don't know, maybe you just know this information, but I'd really like to get sort of the big picture of, we're so siloed, we've talked about that a lot in this committee, we're very siloed between higher ed and health, and yet this is a big crossover, and I mean, what you just said is very compelling, but I'd like to get the bigger picture of how much money the state is putting into various flavors of training for ambulance service so that we can really see, and I realize a lot of that is going to the EMTs, what you've talked about and so on, but it would be really great to get, as we are figuring out how to allocate a smaller number of dollars to get as much impact as we can, that we would kind of understand the whole landscape of this. Thank you.
Who'd like to take that? Director Ferguson.
Chair Wolgamott, Representative Liebling, to your question. Presently, the state, and this is within the base appropriations, the Minnesota legislature appropriates $361,000 each fiscal year. That $361,000 is used to provide for EMS education reimbursements for emergency medical technicians. Presently, that is $900 for an initial EMT course, and is limited to a $325 reimbursement for a refresher education course. So $361,000 a fiscal year is what is presently appropriated to the Office of EMS to administer that program, Representative Liebling.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Well, I should have known you would just have all the figures off the top of your head. But so that's all we're really doing in the space is that money and then this program that's coming through higher ed, and that's all we're doing to try to train the people that we need to staff ambulances throughout the state?
Director Ferguson.
Chair Wolgamott, Representative Liebling, funds related specifically and earmarked for EMS education, that is correct. There are a variety of other funding streams, such as funding our 8 regional EMS systems under Minnesota Statute 144E50. Some of those 8 EMS regions will use some of that funding to work on education initiatives within their own respective areas, but that is typically very focused or you know, a small one-off education program, as I believe the present appropriation to all 8 EMS regions collectively is approximately $1.3 million. There have been a variety of other legislative proposals that have been seen this session that would work towards, making additional investments, looking at different ways to do things. But in terms of specifically earmarked money for education that I'm aware of for EMS, it's the $3 million paramedic scholarship program, and it's the $361,000 appropriation under the volunteer education reimbursement program. And I would just highlight that that criteria is limited on the EMT aspect, is limited to individuals who meet the definition of being a volunteer ambulance attendant. As we see more and more services have to make the transition from volunteer or paid on call to having to increase the number of services that operate in a paid model, we see that the applicability of that starts to decrease, and that's why there's some discussion for some changes in that policy language that's been heard in House and Senate Health.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Liebling. Are there any other member questions on House File 1603? I recognize Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, will this program pay for ALS and BLS participants?
Director Ferguson.
Chair Wolgamott, Representative Noor, to your question, this program is specifically focused for paramedics. So this is for individuals who have taken that initial leap. They have become EMTs. And this is taking the next step in their training. We see that because of those longer course lengths that I talked about, we see that, you know, the tuition costs for that are higher than what we see at an EMT level. And most of, if not, most of our paramedic programs are through the community and technical college system, which makes it the most sense for those funds to be channeled through Office of Higher Ed and as a result through this committee. Representative Noor.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get that clarification. I had that it's only for ALS rather than BLS.
Are there any other member questions for House File 1603? I recognize Co-Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was running through the numbers. Imagine that. And so I see on page 8 of the report that we have in front of us, just shy of 300 recipients and about $1.43 million. And in the ask in the bill, you've got $3.2 million of, in each year. So you've more than doubled what the, I'm assuming what the initial appropriation was in 23. And I'm wondering, I don't know if OHI is in the room. They probably are not, but maybe you will, maybe you know. So, I'm wondering how many applications were there, and I see we have just shy of 300 recipients. Do you know the difference between the two?
Director Ferguson.
Chair Wolgamott, Chair Rarick, to your question. As it relates to, I believe that the, from my understanding, the funding level that is requested was a copy and paste from previous. It's, the program is designed for 2 years, so it would be 3.2 over the course of the biennia. In conversations that I've had with the Office of Higher Education, I am operating under the understanding that the initial 297 scholarships have been awarded in the previous fiscal year, And then the remaining half of that appropriation is being held back because these individuals are able to achieve this scholarship twice. And I believe the intent is for to keep for the upcoming semesters so that that funding is then available for them so they don't have to stop their studies in the middle of their program if that funding were to, you know, disappear. So it's essentially designed for half use in one fiscal year, half use in the second fiscal year, with essentially funding 300 paramedic scholarships and working under the assumption that it can be claimed by an individual up to two times. Chair Rarick, Chair Wolgamott.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on line 2.4, 2.5, it says 3.2 million in fiscal year 26 and the same in fiscal year 27. So it's an actual total then of 6.4 total for the biennium. And if I'm looking at the report, it says basically 1.5 in 1 year. So the two don't line. It looks like it's a double amount.
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the original legislation was a one-time $3.2 million appropriation, and I think the use is intended, as Director Ferguson mentioned. So this would be the same. It was a one-time in, I believe, in fiscal year 26. So it would be the same amount per fiscal year. This would just extend that program so that it would be 3.2 in both fiscal years and then put that in the base as well.
I think we need to ask a nonpartisan fiscal because I'm just not, it's not adding up for me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, I believe if the goal is to, based on the previous legislation, to have $3.2 million in the first year and it's used over a two-year period, if the goal is to translate that to this bill, it would be to split the appropriation in half and over 2 years. But if the goal is to increase the base for the appropriation and simply duplicate the previous bill, then having $3.2 million in each fiscal year would accomplish that.
Okay. Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Okay, so yeah, I think I understand. So it was a one-time appropriation in the first year of the biennium of 3.2 or 3.4 that could be used for both years of the biennium, and now we're doing 3.2 and 3.2 in each of the fiscal years, so that is a 6.4. Okay. All right. Just want to make sure I know what we're doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. Further discussion to House File 1603. I recognize Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. I was just going to point out, you know, based on personal experience with several close relatives that are paramedics and being on coming up on my fifth year of being on the EMS advisory board for the state that supervises the training and getting people into the program and spending a lifetime working with paramedics, kind of taking off what Representative Liebling was saying about the funding, especially when you get out to the greater part of Minnesota. These paramedic services become more of a on-call, so they're not doing it to get rich. They're making a lifetime, a lifestyle commitment to these services to be able to be on-call and provide this life-saving emergency services. So the state is benefited by these programs, and if you think you don't need it, the next time you're on a fishing trip up at the cabin or going to Canada, whatever it is, you know, we need paramedics throughout the state, and this is a good program, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Vice Chair Coulter, closing remarks.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion, excuse me, and thank you, Representative Novotny, and you know, I think, as I said before, we're all aware of the need that exists within our paramedic workforce, and I am grateful that this bill had bipartisan support when we originally brought it forward, and then it does now as well. And so I think, you know, we all see the need, and this is just really a proven way to address it. So thank you.
Vice Chair Coulter renews his motion that House File 1603 be laid over. The bill is laid over. Next up on the agenda is a bill from Representative Hansen. House File 1751. Representative Hansen, would you like to move that your bill be laid over?
Yes, please, Chair.
Representative Hansen moves that House File 1751 be laid over. Representative Hansen, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. House File 1751, in short, will ensure that all contingent faculty get access to insurance on a more reasonable credit structure than what is currently in place at the MNSCU system. And for full disclosure, I am contingent faculty at Metro State, where I co-teach the latest iteration of the model legislature that you're all such big fans of, to graduate students there to hopefully get more people interested in the legislature here. But the stories that I've heard about from other contingent faculty losing their benefits and suffering severe and real-life consequences are heartbreaking, and I want to make sure this legislature is aware of them. And while this does not impact me, given that I have benefits through this body here, I just really felt like it was important that folks are aware that this is happening. The handout explains the specifics, but ultimately the goal here is to be sure that there's adequate, consistent coverage for professors who teach on a contingent status. Contingent faculty do not have contracts that protect ongoing employment from semester to semester, but most have taught within this system for decades. Overall, there are about 3,000 contingent faculty in Minnesota's largest system of higher education. IFO faculty, which are the contingent faculty at the four-year universities, are eligible for 50% employer-sponsored health coverage when they're teaching at least 9 credits, and at 100% if they reach 12, but that's as many as a contingent faculty can teach. So even if they reach 12, we've seen cases where a university will reassign a small portion of a single credit in order to prevent that coverage from kicking in. Contingent faculty often have to teach on multiple campuses to reach the threshold just to keep their insurance coverage, and they cannot take any time off for medical services, vacation, family needs, continuing education, conferences, etc. MSCF faculty at the two-year universities have a slightly different options as listed on the handout, and this bill was brought forward by IFO specifically. If classes are canceled due to low enrollment, which often happens last minute, or if professors put off getting necessary care until they reach their 12 credits, or if they need to take a semester off for the birth of a child, they lose their health care coverage. One professor couldn't risk losing his coverage during his cancer treatment, so he taught online while fighting for his life, and he passed away mid-semester. We think that we can do better to support these professors who are critical to ensuring smooth access to consistent courses for our students at our MNSCU system when full-time faculty are not available, when those faculty are on sabbatical, when they're on family or medical leave, or when they take time off for themselves. I also want to acknowledge the cost of this bill, given the state that we are in the legislature right now, and we understand that that is a big piece of this, but we do want to make sure that we at least get a chance to hear from some of the faculty, and so I thank the committee for taking time to hear this, even given our desperate financial situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Our first testifier is Mr. Jonathan Bone. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, my name is Jonathan Bone. I represent the Interfaculty Organization. We have approximately 4,000 members around the state at all the 7 state universities within Minn State. We also have 1,800 approximately adjunct and community faculty. They are faculty who are traditionally the most marginalized. They have the most precarious employment situation where there is a lot of uncertainty from semester to semester. And as Representative Hansen mentioned, even getting days within the start of a semester, you may lose a course or two and changes your eligibility for all kinds of benefits. So we brought this bill forward and thank Representative Hansen for authoring it. As campus budget crises have continued, our campuses have turned more and more to adjunct faculty and contingent faculty to help balance budgets, to help invest in new programs, and for a variety of other reasons. The goal of the bill is simple. It's to expand healthcare to more of our adjunct and community faculty. We are competing with private institutions, with online institutions, and with just other employment opportunities outside of higher education. And if we want the best faculty available, we need to offer decent benefits. And this is the one benefit that we hear continuously from our contingent faculty that they are missing. Obviously, it has a high price tag, as you see in the fiscal note, and I just want to walk through that really quick. We designed this as a pilot program. You can see it's one-time money. It's for 2 years. And the simple reality is that, as Representative Hansen mentioned, in her case, she has health care through a job. Many of these people will have health care opportunities from either a full-time employer, a spouse, or some other arrangement. So I understand that the system had to cost it the way that they did. And the simple reality is that the vast majority of these people, even if they qualify, will not switch because of the contingency of this type of employment. So if they have permanent health care or more reliable health care through another source, they're going to stick with that, even if CGIP is better, because it's more certain. And so although the fiscal note is crazy, it's fair at this point, but what we were hoping to do is to take these next 2 years to find out what the true cost would be and then move forward under that reality, because it will, we believe, be far, far lower than what the fiscal note says. Ideally, this would be handled in bargaining, and much of our current benefits around healthcare are in our contract. However, as you see the fiscal note, our last contract settlement increased spending for the IFO by about $30 million total. So with that fiscal note, this is not something that we can deal with in bargaining until we have a more realistic vision or more realistic number of what this will actually cost. If that number is as small as we think it will be, then it is a completely viable thing for us to go through the bargaining process or to come back and ask the legislature for ongoing money. But we need to get a better idea of what the actual cost will be. So I'm going to keep my statement there, or my statements there, and turn it over to the people you really need to hear from. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowen. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Emily Oliver. Can you all hear me? Thank you all for having me. I'm one of the two community faculty co-vice presidents of the IFO Union at Metro State University. One thing I just want to really briefly make clear is at Metro especially, and increasingly across the state and nationally, contingent faculty is the norm, right? So we are sort of able to afford higher education at access institutions because we have so many contingent faculty who then don't have access to health insurance. I want to read a letter from my colleague who couldn't be here today, but she's been in the system for 20 years, Chris Frickman. She is an English professor. I hope you will all agree that all state college contingent faculty should be offered the option of healthcare through their respective colleges and universities. As an adjunct and contingent faculty member at Metro State University for over 20 years, I've heard my peers share that they cannot afford health insurance at the salary they're being paid. Many contingent faculty are working at multiple universities to make ends meet, to ease the burden of paying for all medical care. Affordable insurance through the state college and universities should be available to all faculty who wish to opt in or out of health benefits. Administrators at my college understood the IFO contract to read that community faculty, which is what we call adjuncts and contingent faculty, should work up to 12 credits, believing that at 12 credits, the pay would kick into full-time employment or half-time employment, and therefore administrators told departments not to allow contingent faculty to work more than 11 credits, and certainly no more than 11.5 credits a year. Just last year, another community faculty member and myself were each slated to teach 11.99 credits. Keep in mind, there's no such thing as a 0.99 credit. The idea that was that the other 0.01 credit, which is 12 minutes, would be assigned to another faculty member just to keep me and another adjunct colleague from kicking into what was perceived as putting us on the full-time FTE pay scale and making us eligible insurance. The same thing has happened to me. I was assigned 12.5 credits, and I was instructed to give 0.5 credits to another faculty member. I'm going to turn it over to my friend and colleague, Faith. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Faith Erickson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Faith Erickson. Thank you, Chair Wolgamott, Chair Rarick, and all members of the committee. Again, my name's Faith Erickson. I'm an adjunct at St. Cloud State University for the past 17 years and a temporary part-time instructor at St. Cloud Technical and Community College for the past 16 years. That's a long time to spend worrying semester to semester about whether I'll have a job or insurance for the next 6 months. The job might be there, you'll get something, but will it be enough to qualify for insurance? Sometimes you win the lottery like I have right now. You'll get a good dean, one who does his best to make sure as many people as possible get covered, but not everyone can be covered. But I've had 7 deans during my time at St. Cloud Tech, and every single time I've had to start from scratch. Even at year 14, I was walking in, introducing myself like it was a brand new interview, and I'm terrible at interviews. With 7 deans in 16 years and none of them knowing who I am, and I've had no protection. At year 14, a new dean told me he thought it was the most fair to give every contingent faculty member the same course load, 2 classes each, no matter how long they'd been there, even if someone had been hired just days before he came in, which 2 had. I asked him if he understood that meant none of us would get insurance coverage, and he said that he had, and he understood I wouldn't like it, but that's what he thought was the most fair. And I know I'm not alone in stories like this. As a member of the Contingent Appointments Committee for IFO and a chair of the Temporary Faculty Committee for MSCF, I hear stories like this all the time. I'm glad to be joined by Emily today, but I hope to be joined by more of my colleagues, but their lives are full, teaching, running from college to college, overcommitting beyond their classroom duties, because they care about the college and the students, but honestly, many of them are hoping to prove their worth so they'll get enough classes the next semester to qualify for insurance. Some are afraid to speak out because they have no protection either. So I'll share some of their stories. One instructor told me about his technical program. There are just 1 or 2 full-time faculty and the rest are contingent, and it's hard to ask people to do what they need to do for a technical program. Assessment, recruiting, all the extra work needed to do to run a technical program when they're treated like they're temporary. The same instructor was described as exceptional. In fact, he was the only one who was certified to run the technical program the way it was required, but he was on the verge of quitting because his wife needed surgery and he didn't have access to health care. He was terrified he was going to have to pay the $30,000 out of pocket. Another instructor chose to get married despite not being sure if she wanted to because she needed secure insurance. A new father told me his course was dropped just days before the semester started because although his class was full, a full-time instructor's wasn't, and so he had to give his class over, so he didn't have insurance. He told me that instead of paying $39 a month for insurance, his premium jumped to $416 on top of a lower salary with a newborn at home. He cold-called every dean he knew trying to pick up a new class, which is a terribly uncomfortable situation to be in for a contingent faculty whose reputation means a job. But it was right before the semester started, so it was too late. He said he felt like a failure to his new family, and he didn't know if he could keep doing this. Another faculty member told me through her tears that she's a single parent with 3 adopted children, all with mental health challenges due to their prenatal exposure and early trauma. Getting insurance for mental health treatment is already hard, but she was grateful to have succeeded until she lost insurance. Getting approval to place her 9-year-old in residential treatment center, her child had become violent, but she worked with therapists and social workers trying to figure out what to do. She said, "I couldn't stop sobbing and shaking as I thought about my child coming home without the help he needed. The stress impacted my ability to do my job, to take care of my other children, to care for myself. I live in constant fear of that, of losing insurance to support my kids. That fear never leaves. And early in my teaching career, around 2010, I was asked to take over a class. Midway through the semester, I wasn't sure why, and I still probably would do anything to teach a course. And I found out that the original teacher had cancer, and she was teaching until the very last minute so that her kids wouldn't have to pay the insurance cost for her cancer treatment. And she died mid-semester. And in retrospect now, I remember thinking that no matter how much I love teaching, I wouldn't want to spend my last few weeks, my last few days, whatever she did, teaching an online course because I didn't want my kids to pay my insurance cost. But I also wouldn't want to have to leave my kids with my insurance cost. And I wish I would say that that was a 2010 problem, But another colleague recently told me that she lost a colleague to cancer, and that colleague had only one goal in her final year, keep 6 credits, 50% coverage, just enough to maintain her insurance and pay for treatment. As a single person supporting herself, she couldn't take time off to keep her insurance. She worked through December 2024, and she died this January 15th. Too often, we make just enough to be disqualified from MNsure or other insurance, but not enough to actually afford health insurance. I've spent time, a lot of time, speaking with representatives from California and Oregon, where legislation like this has successfully passed. As John said, in both states, the projected cost ultimately proved to be far higher than the actual ones. As he said, many contingent faculty had other coverage or didn't need full insurance plans. The representative from Oregon told me yesterday, because of our legislations, hundreds and hundreds of contingent faculty have been able to obtain insurance who otherwise would not have it. It's literally life-saving, especially as federal attacks on Medicaid and Medicare continue. It's a tough thing that everyone's doing because it's the right thing. We rely on contingent faculty for their dedication and passion. They stay in this work despite decades of uncertainty, and that's not a hyperbole. 15%, I only have statistics for MSCF, but 15% have taught for 20 years or longer, 40% for 10 or more, half for 7 or more. They've dedicated their lives to the job, but this constant instability takes its toll in nearly every way. The mental toll of not knowing what's coming, the physical toll of actually avoiding doctor's visits, not getting surgeries because they don't know if they're going to have insurance when the doctors have to schedule the surgeries semesters out. I have stories of this, but I'll spare you for now. But I say this with conviction. Insurance instability for contingent faculty robs our students of fully present, healthy instructors. And we're thankfully sending more and more Minnesota students to our colleges and universities, but we need to make sure that the mental and physical health of the instructors we're placing in front of those more and more students is not ignored. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Member discussion to House File 1751. I recognize Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Chair Wilgamont. And to the testifiers, I want to thank you for bringing your powerful stories before the committee. This is a situation that we need to find some solution to. And I'm wondering, has there been any discussion about actually surveying the contingent faculty to find out exactly how many would be in need of this insurance so that we could deal with the fiscal note in a more realistic way?
Mr. Bowen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cleburne, thank you for that question. We are working with a graduate program at MSU Mankato that does professional surveying to survey our members to figure out a percentage based on a scientific survey.
That would be wonderful. Yeah. And I will look
forward to it. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. thank you, and we would appreciate receiving that information when you have it. That would be very helpful.
Before we proceed to our next member question, I just wanted to have the opportunity, if there are any other members of the public who are wishing to testify on House File 1751. Okay, seeing none, I recognize Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to thank you for bringing this. Thank you, Representative Hansen. This is really horrible. I'm just really... No, the stories are very impactful. I just want to understand a little bit more. So are the faculty covered through CGIP? Is that was what I thought I heard. Okay. And it sounds like at the beginning of each semester, there's a determination of whether the person is teaching enough to qualify for the insurance every single semester, so every 6 months? Or could you just, because that just seems, you know, and I'll wait for the answer to the question, but it just seems like, couldn't we just do something about that? I mean, anything would help, it seems like, this horrible situation. Anyway.
Mr. Bowen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. The idea of 6 credits was to get at exactly that problem. So right now under the IFO contract, you have to reach 12 credits to be eligible. And that restarts each year. And so you may go the fall semester teaching 6 credits, and then once you're assigned the 6 credits in the spring, you qualify for insurance. You get it for the next 6 months, and then it lapses because it's a new year, new academic year. So you may go 6 months with insurance, 6 months without, you qualify again. And that's part of the idea behind the 6 credits that's in the bill, is to maintain consistency for these people.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you for that. That, because that off again, on again thing, yeah, that's brutal. I so hope we can do something about this. This is really, I don't know how it's been allowed to go on for so long, honestly. It's just really pretty shocking to hear about. So thank you.
Are there any other member questions? I recognize Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and you know, this is interesting. This is the first time I've heard this, and I've been on this committee a long time. I was on the SDRs, the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and even though I review the contracts, I haven't heard this, so thank you for bringing this forward, to bringing this issue forward. I'm also very interested in when the survey will be finished, because we need to start getting cracking on our budget. So all of these things are really important pieces of data. Do you know how soon we'll get that data?
Mr. Bowen.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'm signing the statement of work. It's in my phone right now, as soon as I'm done here today. And we have until the first week of May before their employment ends. So the goal is to get everything wrapped up before then. Hopefully sooner than later, but I can't give you a solid timeline right now. But the idea is to get it done before the end of the semester.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would strongly encourage you to expedite whatever you have to do, because obviously this fiscal number is quite large. I don't think we've actually kind of read it into the record, but the total biennial is 89 million and some change, but 89 million, that's a lot. So, and just to put that into perspective, we did a one-time, basically a freeze for tuition, and that was 75 million. So this is above that. This is a lot. I will say this, though, that having reviewed the IFO and MSCF contracts, I think for about 12 years now, 11, well, somewhere in there, a long time, these are always the lowest cost to the state of Minnesota and the taxpayers. It's always the lowest as far as, like, percentage increase and all of that. So I fully recognize that. And you've done yeoman's work in very difficult situations, and you've had ups and downs, and the 2 years have had a time of it. The MnState 2 years, I know. I understand that. I recognize that. So the sooner you could get us the data, the easier it'll be for us to figure out what to do with that data and how we can, you know, what we can do and how much we can do. But, and if you have any other ideas of how to incrementally get there, I'm all ears. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. I recognize Representative Hicks.
I have a question that maybe it's just I was late, so please forgive me if I misunderstood. But the stories about people being really ill and continuing to work because they need to keep their health care, because they're adjunct, does that mean they're not eligible for FMLA? Is that the reason? Because it's every 6 months? So, like,
Ms. Erickson, if you'd like to come to the testifier table and proceed with your response.
Maybe someone in the audience would be better.
Representative Hansen.
Chair, if I might, I can certainly email this answer back out, and I'll follow up with folks regarding contingent faculty's eligibility for FMLA. But Representative Hicks, generally speaking, in the handout, there's a breakdown of when that coverage kicks in. So there's 50% coverage at 9 credits, and then they need to reach 12 credits. And so it is hard for folks to do that. And whether or not they have FMLA or not, that's not necessarily going to pay their bills.
Can I say one thing?
Yes.
Sorry.
Ms. Oliver.
Thank you.
I had, I was teaching both at the University of Minnesota and at Metro State, so for the state of Minnesota, and I had a baby and didn't get paid parental leave. So it's like really egregious what happens. You know what I mean? I was teaching a full-time load across those two universities.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I just have really strong feelings about making sure that people have health care, but especially our faculty, and also that no one should be put in that position. So I am, like, this is one solution to part of this problem, but it sounds like there's, like, a larger conversation that probably needs to happen. And so I just sort of wanted to highlight that because that seems really gross.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Seeing no further member questions, Representative Hansen, closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, for having this conversation. As I'm sure some of you know, these issues are happening on top of pay issues that happened last year as well. So plenty of our faculty had to transition through a new pay system, which was quite challenging for a lot of folks, myself included. Thankfully, I have other jobs, and I was not as affected. But some folks waited months to even get a paycheck. And so adding these issues on top of it are complex. I'm happy to say those issues have been resolved. Thank you to our system for getting on top of that. But as you've heard today, members, I'm sure you know why I needed to bring this forward to you after I started hearing these stories from some of my coworkers. I appreciate you deeply for taking the time to hear about this and to really hear these stories. We all know that storytelling changes the world, and so even if these funds are not available this year, I hope that you'll keep their stories on your heart and you'll stay open as options do become available. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen moves that House File 1751 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Members, next up on our agenda, we are going to do two presentations, one from Minn State and one from the University of Minnesota, on higher education asset preservation. And although higher education asset preservation, affectionately known as HEPR, falls under the committee budget of the Capital Investment Committee, I thought it was extremely important for us as higher education committee members to be aware of the ongoing HEPR needs in those two systems, because as you'll find in this presentation, it is directly linked to the goals that we have with this committee. We're going to have 15-minute presentations from each system, and then we will open it up to member questions if time allows. Okay, and with that, I see he's still getting his technology ready, but I'm honored to welcome Brian Swanson, the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities at Minnesota State, to discuss their HEPR request. Mr. Swanson, if you're ready, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Swanson. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities with Minnesota State. And today I'd like to talk to you about Minnesota State's request for asset preservation funding. As you will see in a minute, well, we don't need more space, we need better and different space. While HEPR tends to be the focus of asset preservation conversations, our whole capital request is about asset preservation. We're not asking for any net new space, but rather seeking funding to renew, or where it doesn't make sense to renew, to replace existing buildings. And at its core, this request is about providing some pretty basic facilities to serve the students that make up Minnesota's current and future workforce across the state. Minnesota has a history of making higher education convenient and available to all. The state universities, originally the teachers' colleges, the community colleges, and the technical colleges, grew up as three independent, uncoordinated, separate systems. The technical colleges didn't even start out as being the state. They were built and operated largely by local school districts. Higher education within 50 miles of everyone in the state was the goal in the 1960s. And the outcome of that has been that we have facilities all over the state. Minnesota State has 28.5 million square feet of space, over 843 structures on 54 campuses. And now much of that space is over 50 years old, which is a critical turning point in the life of a building. So what do we know about Minnesota State's portfolio? Our colleges and university, our footprint is overbuilt for the current and foreseeable needs. Reduced state investment, rising inflation, and tougher building codes have hampered our ability to keep up with deferred maintenance. There's insufficient resources, both capital and operating, to properly maintain and sustain Minnesota State's colleges, college and university campuses. And like I said, we need different space and better space, not more space. But more importantly, we need your help in replacing, modernizing, and demolishing our buildings. The challenge we face at its core is a math problem. Our expenses are growing faster than our resources. We've stopped adding new academic square footage. Minnesota State hasn't added any new academic space since 2020, and is actively trying to get rid of space. But what we have keeps getting older. As anyone who owns a house or a cabin knows, you can only get so many years, no matter how much maintenance you do, out of your roof, your furnace, your carpet. Eventually, it's just worn out. The roof doesn't magically fix itself, and it never gets cheaper. Buildings decay at a fairly predictable rate. You can see our backlog of deferred maintenance grows at a fairly steady rate because the amount of funding we have to invest in fixing up buildings continues to go down in both actual and inflation-adjusted dollars. The statewide network of higher education facilities was built largely by the legislature. Historically, the renewal and renovation of these buildings was also funded by the bonding process. State operating funds and tuition, the only other sources of funding available, paid for the operating costs of the building, the maintenance, the custodial, the utilities, but it was bonding that paid for the renewal. These state funds and tuition, which have not kept pace with inflation, are not sufficient to fill the capital funding gap without decimating the very programs that bring in the tuition and provide the graduates needed by Minnesota's employers. When expenses go up and revenues go down, the outcome has been that the buildings fall into worse and worse repair. So, three ways you can help. Asset preservation shows up most clearly in three parts of our 2025 funding request. In the operating budget, there's $25 million for demolition and $50 million for repair and replacement. Repair and replacement is, you can think of it as the operating budget equivalent for HEPR. I like to think that as, you know, as you think of it as the way you you can fix up your house, you can some fund some of it out of a checking account, that's like R&R, and get a home equity loan, that's like your HEPR funding. We know you have lots of funding requests and a limited amount of money to spend. I'd say all three of these are very good options, and you can't go wrong with any of them, or if you're feeling generous, all of them. But borrowing a queue from a major online retailer where it's easy to get overwhelmed with choices, I've added a subtle hint on this page about which one would get you the most value for the dollar.
Mr. Swanson, could you, for the number one bestseller, as noted on our sheet in the packet, could you explain a little more in depth that $25 million, the impact that would have? I mean, yeah, it's nice that that'll help with those buildings, but can you explain in depth the impact that would have on ongoing campus budgets?
So, Mr. Chair, members, the $25 million we're estimating right now would demolish about 400,000 square feet of space. We've looked and across the system with more money. We'd be glad to take more. We could probably find about 1.3 million square feet of that 28.5 that we could tear down and demolish. Money you put towards demolition saves on operating costs. We don't have to heat it. We don't have to cool it. We don't have to insure it. It saves on energy efficiency. I mean, it helps towards any sustainability and climate goals. It also reduces our deferred maintenance backlog so that it's money we don't have to worry. We have to spend later on fixing up a roof or a heating system. So you get about a triple or quadruple win out of each of those programs. And the ongoing savings, which pay for themselves again and again and again, allow campuses to put their resources into academic programs or other needs on campuses. So it's a phenomenal use of money.
Rather than having those ongoing costs and buildings that are outdated and out of use, that would net a cost savings that could go directly into students and adjunct faculty or any of the other needs across the campus. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not arguing that the recommendation you're making is appropriate or inappropriate. I'll start with that. But whenever I think about demolition, just words on a piece of paper, it doesn't tell me what kind of buildings, what kind of space are we taking down? Is there absolutely no other repurpose for this building, even if it's for some cause other than the institution itself? So, I mean, we do have needs in our state for different types of buildings, and I'm just wondering if there's any way to repurpose it outside of the institution itself.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a good question. I think most of these buildings that would be the high priority are at the end of their useful life and would require significant investment. Oftentimes, the amount of money you'd have to put in would be more than you would pay if you just were going to go out and build a building that was actually built for that purpose. They might not be in the right geographic location. They probably have code deficiencies. They might have been built for a special purpose. If it was an engineering lab or something, for example, and there's a need in the community for housing, those just aren't going to be compatible. So I think we would always look at that. But the list that's been put together to date, I think, are pretty much at the end of their life.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Swanson, if you would please proceed with your presentation.
HEPR, which is the one that we're most familiar with, Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement. This is a legislatively created program set up in the early 1990s by the legislature with some very strict rules for how the funds can be used. It's the most important bond funding you give us, and it also, unfortunately, seems to be the first that gets cut in the bonding bill development. As you can see from the photos, these projects are not glamorous, but they are very important. The HEPR funding renews building envelopes, roofs and windows, replaces plumbing, electrical, heating and cooling and ventilation systems, resolves building code and accessibility deficiencies, improves energy efficiency, and upgrades utility infrastructure. Making these kinds of improvements early makes buildings last longer and reduces the need for whole buildings to be replaced or new buildings to be built. These are just a few visual examples. Our list includes critical projects across the system where we are on the verge of major system failure. 2 weeks ago, I toured a campus where 50% of their campus, about 400,000 square feet of space, is heated by two original 1970s era boilers, one of which started leaking recently and had to be patched, welded, and recertified to keep the campus heated. We simply cannot operate our campuses on the amount of money we have. If we don't get help from you, our only other option for making these necessary repairs is tuition. So our overall capital program, I just focus on the bottom line, renewal, replacement, renovation, and demolition. This request is not about adding. Everything in the request adds towards asset preservation in one way or the other. These are student-focused physical improvements that make a big difference to how the campus operates. So the overall capital request, just as a reminder, is $200 million of HEPR. It funds 65 projects throughout Minnesota, really focuses on those the renewal of critical systems and infrastructure. And then on the remainder of the capital request, we have 14 major projects, five of which you have previously provided funding for design. And that's a quick overview of our asset preservation needs.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. We have just a few minutes for member questions. I recognize Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've never served on this committee before, and I've never served on capital investment, but I've always wondered this. When we build something new, say we put money there to build a new lab or whatever, does the system put aside any money for depreciation? Is there any, you know, we fund this new building. Is there any, you know, are we taking account of the fact that anything, even if you build it new, needs upkeep? And so how does that work? Are we just negligent that we just wait until it's falling apart and then we say, whoa, we need, and I mean we, the legislature, I don't mean you, the system. I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm just saying that, you know, are we doing this in a way that makes sense so that down the line we actually have funds available?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, You asked a really good question. Historically, that major system renewal of buildings was funded by the legislature. The day-to-day operations and of the buildings was funded through tuition and the O&M appropriation. Each of the campuses sets aside a small amount of money for what's called repair and replacement, and so that's the idea here is that with a non-recurring $50 million, we could increase what they can do. Anything that doesn't come from the general appropriation, which takes away from students and teaching and faculty, has to come from tuition, which is the same impact on the system. So their short answer is no. There is no big pot of money out there, and there hasn't been an ability to fund a recurring pot like that.
Anything further, Representative Liebing?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I have a lot to learn about how this works, but it would just seem that when we fund a new building, that there ought to be some element of that that is set aside also for that upkeep and so that we don't end up in this situation years later.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, it says here 9 buildings would be slated for demolition. And you mentioned before that there would be cost savings eventually from those buildings, not having to heat them and all the things. Do you have a number on what the savings would be once those buildings are down? Thanks.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we have some calculations, and I thought I had them with me, but we can follow up with you on that.
Mr. Swanson, can you please speak? You know, we've seen the pictures. We've talked about the numerical impact, but what kind of impact do these does this backlog and deferred maintenance have on enrollment and on recruiting students to attend to get their college education on the throughout the MnState system?
Mr. Chair, admissions people could probably speak to this much better than I could, but a huge portion of a student's decision to attend a campus is made within the first 10 or 15 minutes of their arrival on campus. And if they are coming from a high school that has labs or spaces that are better than what they're seeing at their colleges, and they can go across the border to River Falls or South Dakota or North Dakota or even Iowa, where they have been making investments in their facilities, a lot of them leave and they don't come back.
Thank you. Unless there are any other member questions, Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quick, I was going to hold off on making this comment until after the next presentation, and I even actually thought about making it on Representative Hansen's bill because it's basically the same comment. I think this is my first time this term saying this, but this is the perfect example of pay me now or pay me later. And, you know, the reality is, the joke I sort of make is that our correction system doesn't quite have the same difficulty recruiting people to use their facilities as our colleges and universities do. But that is a real issue. We know it is that when folks see in the news that dorm roofs are collapsing and they go and visit places and see buildings that are in disrepair, we know that that's a huge issue. And so the result is that if we aren't paying up front, if we aren't making the investments to keep up these facilities at our colleges and universities, that it's only going to come out on the other end, either because students aren't going to go to these colleges and universities, or it's going to end up hitting families' pocketbooks because schools have to raise tuition. So I know, obviously, we don't fund this out of our committee, but I just really, really want all of us, as we're thinking about our priorities for a bonding bill this year, to remember that fact. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Vice Chair Coulter. All right. Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Swanson. Next up, I would like to welcome Alice Robert Davis, the Vice President for University Services at the University of Minnesota, to discuss their HEPA request. Ms. Roberts Davis, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott and Chair Rarick and members. My name is Alice Roberts-Davis. I'm Vice President for University Services at the University of Minnesota, and I am also pleased to be joined today by our Regent, Regent Mary Turner. Regent James Farnsworth was here earlier, as well as some of our faculty. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to walk through our 2025 state capital request. Our 2025 request includes just two items. First, HEPR remains our top priority. It's our main source of funding for facility renewal and upkeep. Reinvestment extends the life and functionality of our assets and continues to be the most cost-effective approach. We have a long list of projects, and we would tackle them with our $200 million ask. Many of these are critical projects that have been on our list for several years now. Our second request is around the future of advanced agricultural research in Minnesota, or FARM, and that will create a real-world teaching, research, and outreach farm in southern Minnesota to help farmers and industry meet this crucial moment in sustainable food production. I'll talk about that a little more in just a moment, but I'll start with HEPR. For the university, our greatest need on the capital side is regular, reliable funding dedicated to renewing existing buildings and infrastructure. We have old buildings. The majority of our inventory is over 50 years old, and we're learning that old buildings create new problems. 8.8 million square feet of our space, we have about 30 million square feet total, is now considered poor or critical, and that figure continues to grow each year. We need a regular, reliable source of funds to solve this challenge. Fully funding our $200 million request would fund over 100 projects in more than 75 buildings across the state. State bond funding is less predictable and more inconsistent than ever. The funds we receive are most often a combination of asset preservation dollars and new capital requests. So there's often very little focus on reinvesting in our existing assets. There's also very little ability for us to predict either how much funding we will get or if we will get any funding. So planning a phased project over a series of years or trying to develop individual projects with plans based on state funding availability is not possible. Historically, higher education was the largest recipient of state bond funding. This chart is specifically focused on capital funding that has been provided when the state issues bonds to fund construction and repair of state assets. These large capital appropriations from the state were responsible for constructing a majority of the buildings on our campuses, but unfortunately, regular renewal funding has not been coming as steadily as other funding. So where higher education had been as much as 50% of the bonding bill, we now receive only about 10% of the bonding bill, and that's shared with Minnesota State. The cumulative impact of this is underinvestment that has resulted in a 10-year renewal need of $6 billion for the university. 28% of our space across the system is now considered to be in poor or critical condition. With predictable funding and increased efforts to consolidate our space, we can and will start to reverse that trend. To Chair Wolgamott's earlier point, this is not just about buildings. This is really about what students need and expect when they enter our facilities. They want them to reflect the environments in which they'll work after they graduate. We cannot recruit, retain, and graduate top talent, and in our current situation, we can't address the state's acute workforce challenges if we're not graduating students, and the spaces that they're learning in really do have an impact on how they choose to start their educational journey. We are partners in this. The economic impact from the university, based on our recent economic impact study, shows that the U of M supports 75,000 jobs across the state, and our economic impact is $11.5 billion annually. So we are mutually invested in the success of the U. I'll give you just one real-world example of how HEPR requests include long-overdue renovation at the Food Science and Nutrition Building on the St. Paul campus. This is a 1956 facility. It's home to a nationally known and ranked Food Science and Nutrition Department. The program is an absolute gem, but the building leaves so much to be desired. It's a situation where there are portions of the building where electrical and water are intermixed, and students come here for hands-on learning with lab work, product development, and real-world applications and plant protein and food piloting, or food plant pilots. Sadly, the building is so outdated that we cannot install the latest industry equipment even when it's been offered for donation. Our neighbors in North Dakota and Michigan State, Kansas State, and Illinois have all made major investments in their food science buildings, and we will continue to lose students to those programs if we don't match their modernized facilities. In fact, we met with one representative 2 weeks ago who said that his daughter went to a competitive program based on the facilities that she saw when she came on our campus. Students need and expect the facilities that they'll learn in will reflect the work that they'll do every day in the future, and we really do strive to provide them with that top experience that matches the programming that happens in the buildings. Moving on to farm, I'd like to take just a moment to talk about our request for $20 million from the state for advanced design for farm. Farm aims to deliver practical solutions for today and forward-looking ideas for tomorrow using cutting-edge technology like predictive analytics, big data, robotics, and artificial intelligence in farming. We are planning to educate students, industry partners, and Minnesota farmers on modern approaches to agriculture that will ensure a continued talent pipeline and continue us as a leader in agriculture. The university has already assembled more than 1,300 acres in Maurer County for this project. We are finalizing a pre-design now. We are partnering with Hormel as well. This is a visionary project that will take us through the entire life cycle in studying education and research from everything from soils to how those affect the crops, how that affects animals, how that affects people when we eat them as protein, and how people infect the environment. So it would be a cutting-edge project, and we'd love to have it here in the state of Minnesota. We always like to end with this slide where we talk about the state funding that we receive and how we put it to good use immediately. Our track record has been to spend about 90% of any dollars invested within 2 years of an appropriation. And as we reported to you earlier this year, 85% of our 2023 appropriation has already been allocated to renewal projects. Our capital investments go into the local economy, and about 90% of our expenditures go back into Minnesota companies, and we're very proud of that. So with that, I'll stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any member questions? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both in state and the U for your testimony. I find this super frustrating, as I'm sure you do, more than we do probably. And hearing, you know, the needs of the faculty as well. And on the HEPR request specifically, because it's bonding money, I was surprised to learn you thought you would probably get 10% in a typical year of the total bonding amount. Because my understanding, based on the new forecast in February, is that the bonding amount has been reduced to roughly, give or take, $700 million. So that would mean $70 million for HEPR split between the two systems. Like, it's stunning, honestly.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest frustrations, I would say, is that being built across the street from where we are sitting is a $730 million new state office building bonded for, when that could have covered easily the $200 million for both systems. And the waste that we are seeing of taxpayer dollars right across the street when we have these huge needs across the state. And I tried. I tried to stop the bonds. I tried to repay the bonds. I tried six ways from Sunday to stop that thing. And it is continuing to be built. But it... it's greatly concerning what the priorities have been in the last 2 years in this session, and I'm just incredibly frustrated to realize the scope of the need, and now because of the deficit, we have a lower bonding amount than projected. So I know we can't stop the construction across the street because I've tried so many times, But I hope that every time we all walk over there, we feel regret about the priorities that this body has made versus the needs around our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further member discussion, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you very much, Chair Wogmont. And I would like to start with the fact that we, the legislature, are responsible for decades of neglect of state assets. We've had opportunity multiple decades to make the investments since 1956 to keep this food science lab up to date. I have a child who has a PhD in food science and went to another state to acquire her PhD. And I would just like for you to mention, if you can, the temperatures that can be reached inside this food science building, if you don't mind.
Ms. Roberts-Davis.
Chair Wolgamott, Representative Cleavorn. I know that in the summertime it is unbearably hot in the building. There have been days where they have not been able to work successfully in the building because of the heat. There is no air conditioning. It should be a temperature-controlled building. They're working with food and plant products, and so it is not a temperature-controlled building at all. I can't give you the specific temperatures, but I know that it is a huge challenge for them to do the work that they're there to do.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. I also want to, thank you for putting this on your HEPA request. And I think it's a long overdue. The other thing I would like to do is just kind of level set. We always hear this number of whatever, 700 million. When we talk about HEPA requests, when we talk about bonding, when we talk about all these numbers, we generally refer to them in the initial cost phase. We don't generally calculate in all of the interest that will be paid over decades. I'm not saying that that wouldn't be the final cost at the end of the day, but I would like all of our comparisons to be apples to apples, right? So when we talk about 200 million in HEPA requests over the 30-year period of the life of the bonds, it would be significantly more than 200 million. And so the same is true with the state office building. The cost, as it's being discussed for the state office building, and that was approved by a bipartisan vote, I want to make sure that everybody understands that, was not in the $750 million range. I believe as I look at the cost for that proposed state office building, it was in the $400 million range, not $700 million. So that is just level setting, apples to apples. But again, it is our responsibility to maintain these state assets, and I believe that your HEPA request is very reasonable, and we have had, as is Minnesota State's asset preservation, and we have an obligation to the students and to the institutions to make sure that we are doing what we are charged with doing as well. Thank you so much.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont. Thank you for taking the time to be here today to present your HEPA request. I guess I am a student or a former student in the University of Minnesota, and I can attest to the fact that you've had facilities since 2000 that have needed drastic upgrades, especially around the agriculture side of it. It's very frustrating to see a land-grant university stepping backwards on a regular basis with staff that's attempting to try to step forward. I was just kind of wondering, I've asked this question before, to my calculations, there's been over $80 million worth of land sales over at the Rosemont facility as piece by piece by piece that research location gets sold off. Where are those dollars currently located, and do you actually have a total on how much has been sold out there in terms of Well, actually, University of Minnesota-wide, as far as how much agriculture or College of Agriculture resources and extension resources have been sold over the last 20-year period of time. And if that's sitting in an account somewhere to be utilized for the farm facility, because I've requested this once before, and I haven't heard anything from you guys. So,
Ms. Roberts-Davis.
Chair Wolgamott, Representative Allen, thank you so much for the question. You're absolutely right. The funds have been used for the farm project, the 1,300 acres that we've assembled down in Maurer County for that particular project. I don't have the 20 years of sales off the top of my head, but I apologize that that information was not given to you promptly. We will do that immediately.
Anything further, Representative Allen?
Yes, a follow-up. I will totally agree with Representative Cleavorn over listening to several parents that have been extremely frustrated that the University of Minnesota hasn't been able to keep up to its obligation as a land-grant university to actually move agriculture research forward. It has a rich tradition going all the way or going back, and Norman Borlaug was just a phenomenal example of it. But it's hard to be able to create more Norman Borlaugs if we don't have the funding to be able to do it, and we don't have the ability to be able to get those facilities up to make them competitive with our neighboring states. It's a true brain drain that we're seeing here in the state of Minnesota. Our best and brightest, especially in ag research and agriculture, are going to other states. And I really hope you guys take a serious look and actually commit the funding to be able to fix that, along with Bailey Hall and several of the facilities in St. Paul, to get it up to standard. Thank you.
For a final comment, Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we are over time, but I just wanted to comment really quickly about the $25 million of deconstruction, we'll just call it demolition, has to be general fund money. It cannot be bonding money because you're not building anything, you're tearing it down. So that would be on us to have to do that. The last thing I would say is I just got the data back from the University of Minnesota. I had asked for their top 100 salaried people, and I'm going to talk briefly. So it's when you go from the top to the 100th person, they're still at $354,000 at the University of Minnesota. And I have data from 2023 from a government transparency group, and they had asked for anybody that was paid more than the governor, which was at that point $128,000. And that list of employed people at the University of Minnesota is 2,169 people paid more than the governor. And with that, thank you, and we have to be out of here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quickly, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you very much. And I told you I had looked at the 990s for the other institutions that came and talked to us about state funding state funding. Some of those individuals are paid in excess of $750,000.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn, and thank you, Ms. Roberts-Davis. There being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.